Welcome to the Best of Counterspin for 2015. I'm Janine Jackson. All year long, Counterspin brings you a look, as we say, behind the headlines of the mainstream news. That's both to shine a light on aspects of emerging stories that might be marginalized or off the page entirely in corporate media, and to remind us to be generally mindful of the practices and policies of elite media that make it an unlikely arena for a full, vital debate on issues that matter, in which those outside of social and economic power can have their voices heard and their ideas acknowledged. So we bring you these selections from the year just gone, not to say that these were the most important stories or the most ignored perspectives, but just to say that these are some of the cases that illustrate the kinds of questions we ought to always be thinking about as we read the paper or watch the news. You are listening to the Best of Counterspin. The President's State of the Union address brings out the big guns of conventional wisdom. After Barack Obama's January speech, the word from CNN's Jake Tapper and Wolf Blitzer was that Obama had laid out a very progressive, very liberal economic agenda that would have been too politically risky for him before the midterm elections. Journalist and activist Keen Bott told Counterspin what that description said about elite media's connection to public opinion.
Jake Tapper, by terming them very liberal, the kinds of policies that include, say, paid sick leave or requiring employers to provide paid maternity leave or raising the minimum wage or a community college that is free for attendees. They might be described as liberal, perhaps, but if you look in public opinion poll after public opinion poll, you see vast majorities of the U.S. public, including self-described Republicans and conservatives, support those types of measures. So, for example, minimum wage has an over 70% approval rating, with majority of Republicans and conservatives supporting that. And in fact, in the midterm elections, when these proposals were put on ballot initiatives to increase the minimum wage, Republican states like Arkansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and Alaska passed them by substantial margins. Same goes with providing paid sick leave and paid maternity leave. It just makes economic sense. And I think that one of the problems with deeming this very progressive and very liberal is that it's implied that this is somehow polarizing. And I think it leads to the second part, which is that Wolf Blitzer made these appear to be liabilities for politicians. So he said that because Obama feared that they would hurt Democrats who were up for re-elections or elections, he was afraid to roll out such proposals, when in fact, because of their broad support across the political spectrum, that they would have assisted these kinds of Democrats in energizing the electorate to vote for an economic platform that provided immaterial improvements in their daily lives. What I argue in the blog is that there are deeper issues at play, which is that while they may be very popular policies amongst voters, policies that extract concessions from wealthy elites and businesses are not so popular amongst those who largely finance the elections. And let's remember that in addition to having perhaps the lowest voter turnout in modern history in the midterms, this last midterm was also the most expensive of all midterms. So I think that there's a material basis for why Democrats do not roll these kinds of measures out when they are so busy and so intent in competing for election financing amongst an economic elite that's very deeply opposed to these kinds of measures.
The movie Selma depicted the struggle for the Voting Rights Act in a way millions of Americans found compelling. But op-ed writers at the nation's big papers complained. The movie was too hard on Lyndon Johnson, with Johnson advisor Joseph Califano using the Washington Post to contend that, quote, in fact, Selma was LBJ's idea, close quote. We talked to Fair's own Jim Narikas about all of that.
The film does take some liberties with the chronology of things, but if you were to see the film and then to read these op-eds, you would get a more accurate depiction of history from the fictional film than from the supposedly factual op-eds. For example, the idea that the relationship between Johnson and King was not contentious and that King and Johnson were not at odds is belied by the actual tapes that were made by Johnson in the White House. There's one tape where he is talking to Bill Moyers, who was an aide as well, and Johnson says of King, "He better get to behaving himself or all of them are going to be put in jail." Well, that sounds pretty contentious. And what he's upset about is the fact that there were sit-ins at the Justice Department and the White House protesting the fact that the federal government was not doing anything to protect marchers who were trying to go from Selma to Montgomery to protest the lack of voting rights. And you have to wonder if the relationship between Johnson and King was so harmonious, why are civil rights activists sitting in at the White House?
Hoover was his guy as well, right?
Right. Hoover was the chief of the FBI under Johnson, and Johnson reaffirmed his place there. In the film, Hoover is depicted as sending sex tapes to Coretta Scott King, King's wife, in an effort to discredit him. The critics have been very upset that the movie implies, but doesn't really say, that this was Johnson's idea. The actual historical record shows that when Hoover's FBI sent particularly incriminating tapes to the White House, they were seen by Johnson's top aide. This is Walter Jenkins, his closest aide for like 25 years. In a memo to Hoover from one of Hoover's aides, it says, "Jenkins was of the opinion that the FBI could perform a good service to the country if this matter could somehow be confidentially given to members of the press." So the idea that Johnson was willing to use incriminating information about King against him, it's not made up by the filmmakers of Selma. It's part of the historical record.
Well, it isn't, in your view, just that these critics are getting the history of the relationship between Lyndon Johnson and Martin Luther King wrong. You think they're getting the movie wrong in a way, too, that it's not about smearing Johnson really at all.
Yeah, I think that there's an expectation from Johnson's associates that this movie should be a celebration of Johnson with him as the hero of the civil rights movement. And by making the character of Johnson, he's not an unsympathetic character. He's not an opponent of civil rights. He's someone who is telling Martin Luther King that the time is not right just then for a Voting Rights Act, and that they ought to wait, which is actually what the historical Lyndon Johnson actually said to the historical Martin Luther King. He said, "I'm going to do it eventually, but I can't get voting rights through in this session of Congress." And the movie is really the story of how King, through the civil rights movement, through demonstrating the nastiness of racist violence in the South, captured the national attention and convinced Lyndon Johnson that this was, in fact, the time to have a Voting Rights Act that would give blacks the political power that would enable them to get justice when they were subject to violence.
We don't need to look to history to see the effort of official powers to control the storyline. We see it often in the coverage of cases of violence by law enforcement. Carlos Miller is the founder of Photography is Not a Crime, a website he started while himself being prosecuted after filming police, an activity that he explained is not a panacea for police violence, but is a game changer.
I was on a journalistic site, on a freelance assignment for a local website, doing some project on a street called Biscayne Boulevard, and I came across a group of cops who were making an arrest. I started taking photos. They told me this is a private matter. I told them this is a public road, and then they proceeded to come after me. They pounced on me. They tripped me. They bashed my head into the pavement. They broke a lens, a flash, and they threw me in jail on 9 misdemeanors. And none of the misdemeanors has anything to do with photography, because photography is not a crime. But they made up the story that I was standing in the middle of the street blocking traffic, where the photo I took, the last one I took before I was arrested, showed the street was behind them. So I launched the blog in an attempt to clear my name in the hopes that the state attorney's office would drop the charges, and they proceeded to convict me and to take me to court. So this became a long battle, and the blog in the meantime became very popular because, you know, in 2007 was when the iPhone was introduced. YouTube was becoming very popular for the first time in history. People had access to technology where they were able to record scenes on the street and upload it to the internet in a matter of minutes. So it was true freedom of the press for the first time in history, and police were not accustomed to that accountability. So they were sending me their stories. Police were making these arrests, and while I was waiting for my trial, I would write about these stories because nobody else was. The mainstream media wasn't really concerned about the citizens getting arrested. They were only concerned if one of their own reporters were getting arrested. So there was nobody actually documenting these cases, so I became that person. You know, here we are in 2015. The site is now, we have a huge team. We're growing. We have people in every state. We have an investigative team. You mentioned all these cases from last year, Eric Gardner and all these cases were that were caught on video. Well, now people are very well aware of their right to record, and police are well aware that people have the right to record, but the police are still making these arrests because they know they will get away with it. They know there's no disciplinary action against them. So it doesn't really matter to them. They will still clamp down on people making videos of them to prevent the truth from coming out because police, they've been so accustomed to creating their own narrative by writing whatever truth they believe. And that's always, for decades, that's always been taken as gospel in the courts. So this is a new era right now.
Communities of color face more struggles than police violence. Many people are still struggling not only with inadequate income, but with the elimination of support that resulted from the 1996 so-called Welfare Reform Act. When Counterspin spoke with professor and author Felicia Kornbluh, Bill Clinton was using the New York Times to take a rhetorical victory lap on the law's 10th anniversary, with an op-ed heralding the bipartisan effort to cut people off aid.
I think you're right to point to the way Clinton put his spin on the law after 10 years and the way that mainstream, often reputedly liberal media organs like the New York Times will still very often talk about the success or the consensus, the political consensus around welfare. I have to say, you know, working now as an academic, I think social scientists and other academics have often made the same kind of mistake. They have asked the wrong questions and therefore have gotten the wrong answers. And that's really been true since the debate that produced this law, and then even more in the assessments, right? So instead of asking how are we doing on alleviating poverty, how are we doing on providing genuine equality, how are we doing on providing a really thriving environment for children, how are we doing on women's equality, you know, instead we ask, did the welfare rolls go down? And that's true, they did. By hook or by crook, they went down. And we ask, you know, who's in the labor market? How many people are in the labor market? As though that tells us something about the social good, which it doesn't.
Well, the whole premise there was, not very veiled from some quarters during the debate, was that people who were receiving public assistance could be in the workforce. They were just choosing not to for laziness or, you know, childcare or however you wanted to spin it. So for many people, I think if you can say that they are no longer receiving welfare and that they are in a job, then that's it. That's all it was claimed to do. The devil's in the details there, I assume. What kind of job? They came off the welfare rolls and went where? Yeah, and that's the sort of informational void, I guess, that we're looking at.
Well, I would say there actually are two problems with that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of politics of, you know, yay, we lowered the welfare rolls, or yay, we got people into the labor market, I think it's dumb liberalism, and I think it's dumb feminism or fake feminism in a way that's very, very damaging and is far too present in our culture. Not only do we have a labor market that's totally flawed, in which we know that there are relatively high levels of structural, that is to say, permanent unemployment, so not everyone literally can get a job, you know, not only do we know that child care is not available for any amount of money in some parts of the country, certainly not affordable, high-quality child care available in many, many parts of the country for many, many families, but also, in addition to talking about that flawed labor market, that flawed child care market, et cetera, I think we also have to talk about the work that parents do. And that's an appropriate subject for feminism, for liberalism, for progressivism. And, you know, what's happened to that? What's happened to that whole conversation around the fact that the work parents do actually is valuable, and being with children, having children, you know, be like happy and thriving, that's actually a social good. It's a social value. Why do we not value that?
Well, and it seems to also call for the integration, the total integration of questions about public assistance into our other questions that we are seeing activism around, things like the minimum wage, things like student loans. I mean, if we don't integrate those concerns, it seems hard to put forward a really kind of holistic economic vision.
Well, I think that's absolutely right, too. I've been very encouraged. I mean, in general, our political climate is depressing, and the fact that nobody's even talking about what we used to call welfare anymore is really concerning. However, the Fight for 15 by workers who most people think, you know, don't have any power in our political system, and the incredible successes that that movement has had is very encouraging. And Black Lives Matter, I think, also is really encouraging on this. And I think if we talk about how Black Lives Matter in the what we call the criminal justice system, I think we can also talk about how Black Lives Matter in the anti-poverty world. And we can ask why we continue to have a system that, you know, impoverishes and starves and actually kills, according to some data, low-income people, not exclusively, but disproportionately African-American, Latina.
Part of corporate media's mantra is that capitalism and human rights go hand in hand. And the United States, anyway, is engaged in a more or less steady march of progress. Proof is meant to be found in the increased visibility of socially marginalized groups, like, for example, transgender people. Without denying real advances, author and professor Dean Spade suggested visibility was not the best barometer.
I think that there's an assumption generally in U.S. politics that visibility is kind of the goal of social movements, and that marginalized groups or hated groups, right, like trans people, that's the winning moment is when people see us and see somebody who's one of us and don't hate that person, where we get represented in a TV show or on the cover of Time in some way that people consider respectable. And I have some real questions about that. I think on the one hand, you're right. There can be positive experiences for us of seeing people like us in the public eye. And for some people, that might mean they're a little less afraid to come out or something like that. That kind of thing is hard to quantify. I think the real question, though, is does that visibility by itself actually transform the conditions that are endangering trans people's lives? And my answer would be no. And in fact, sometimes what it can do is create a false story that our struggles are over or that we've achieved the big wins. And I think one of the words I've been thinking about with this is, you know, how is right now the moment when a mainstreamable trans politics or trans identity is being circulated? So not that actual trans lives and the range of struggles trans people have and the experiences trans people are having in prisons and shelters and welfare offices and the, you know, kinds of real on-the-ground things are shortening trans people's lives, those are not necessarily in the spotlight or being remedied, but instead a very narrow version of a story about trans people that's assimilable to current U.S. norms is being circulated. And the relationship between that and trans well-being, I think, is questionable.
Yes, well, a typical story would start, and I've read a bunch of them, would start with Caitlyn Jenner, and then say something about how trans people are all the rage, and that really is a phrase that I found in a news article. And then somewhere lower there will be a graph that I call the sobering statistics graph, you know, and it'll sort of tick off higher rates of incarceration, suicide, poverty. But that information isn't integrated logically into the story. So you kind of get a sense that well, it's bad for some people, but somehow Caitlyn Jenner is proof that it's things are steadily improving. It is almost, as you've intimated, it's like it's two different stories happening.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing that's interesting about the way that story proceeds is if it does ever get into the, you know, so what does this progress mean besides just that we see Caitlyn Jenner on TV, it'll say something about, often about some institution or law starting to recognize trans people. So it might bring up the fact that there's the federal hate crimes law now includes gender identity. It'll bring up something that indicates, or might bring up the fact that now the U.S. military is considering getting rid of the ban on trans people in military service. So it'll say that the answer would be, again, this kind of moment of recognition in law. That's kind of like the hardest core thing it gets to as a real there. Mm-hmm. And a lot of my work has been about looking at how that itself is actually, those reforms themselves are actually incredibly surface reforms that are more likely to serve the institutions that get to say, hey, now we recognize this hated group. Now we are a site of liberty and equality. Now we have crossed the final frontier. Meanwhile, the actual conditions for trans people, again, unlikely to change, right? So even if the federal hate crimes law says you can't kill people on the basis of gender identity, that does nothing to actually reduce the number of trans people who are being killed. That is ongoing, nor to really think about how the main perpetrator of violence against trans people is the criminal justice system itself, not this kind of fantasy about the random person who attacks us. So the idea is, you know, that supposedly now we're equal and we're treated as humans because we've been recognized in this law, but then the reality is that the criminal system, through hate crimes laws, gets to say, oh, hey, look, now we've included this group. Meanwhile, it keeps on targeting and harming us. So, you know, I think we could say the same thing about the military. So one of the things I'm curious about with this visibility, this mainstreaming, this moment of recognition, is how is it actually a boon for the institutions, and I think we could include the media, who want to say, look, we're now doing a good job by these people. Meanwhile, those same institutions could be harming us, and the conditions that are really, you know, facing the community haven't been touched or addressed, like poverty, like mass incarceration.
Corporate media shortchange the public and democracy, not just with the narrow elite worldview they often reflect in the stories they tell, but in the bias and priorities reflected in the stories they ignore. We talked with writer, producer, and former Counterspin host Laura Flanders about a project that explores alternative economic visions. Alternative, that is, to the workplace models that elite media generally present as the only viable option.
We always used to say you can't be what you can't see. And our commercial media plays a huge role in showing us what it is to be in the workforce, what it is to have a successful business. And for the most part, you've got it right. The pictures we see are of the race to the top, breed is good winner, usually some, you know, tug on your bootstraps individual hero played by, who knows, in the movies. It's a picture of a solitary actor achieving tremendous wealth pretty much on his own and living the great American dream. Most of us know that's not actually how life works. It's certainly not our experience. And this project that I've been engaged in now for years is to lift up another kind of experience. As you said, not just an idea, but real-life people right now, right here, doing business and making livelihoods a whole different way.
Well, yes, because all that can really explode those myths about, you know, the lionizing of the tycoon who is perversely wealthy, you know, and no longer has to work. That's the sign of success. Or the ideas about sharing being assumed to be a disincentive to striving. The real way to explode those myths is with examples. What have you been up to on this? I know that there is a video project. I've also seen written articles. What are you working on?
We have a brand new documentary made with the Toolbox for Education and Social Action, TESA, that is now available at our website. It's called Own the Change, Making Workplace Democracy One Worker-Owned Co-op at a Time. And what it really is our conversations with co-op worker owners from around the country and the world about their challenges, their successes, what's rewarding for them, what's difficult for them. And, you know, in the process of talking to them about what is difficult about making a worker co-op work, making it successful, we came back to media because so many people in the video said, we're just not given much training in making decisions democratically. We don't have much experience of making decisions together. So one of the very challenging things about co-ops is trying to get, if not consensus, then at least democratic process in place in the workforce. Once they've got it down, it's exciting. And the worker owners we talk to, like the people at the New Era Windows Factory in Chicago, you'll remember them as Republic Windows and Doors, who occupied their factory in the height of the recession in 2008. Those folks said, you know, we thought we were just window workers, window makers. But as we tried to create our own worker-owned cooperative, which I've written about over the years, we found we could do a whole lot more than that. We could lay pipe. We could lay down insulation. We could design the office. In fact, we could design the work floor, the production floor, better than the bosses designed it because we know where the efficiencies could be and how people actually use the machines. Stories like that were really validating and exciting. And I think we came away with a sense of, you know, this isn't easy and co-ops aren't for everybody and maybe the world isn't going to be saved by a million more worker-owned co-ops. But the very process of bringing a critical eye to the way that we do business now and lifting the lid on the many hundreds of stories that are existing in the U.S., stories just waiting to be told of people creating livelihoods that are more in keeping with their communities, with their lives, with their families, with each other, and finding ways to make a viable living, it's worth the effort. It's worth the effort to try to organize your workplace differently, and it's certainly worth the effort to tell these stories. After years, you and I know, years of talking about everything that's wrong in the world, it sure is fun once in a while, not to mention really stimulating, to think about, well, how could we do it differently? And to talk to people who are doing just that.
We hope you've enjoyed the Best of Counterspin for 2015. Counterspin is produced each and every week by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of this show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them all on FAIR's website. It's fair.org. The website's also the place to show support for Counterspin if you're so inclined. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you very much for listening to the Best of Counterspin.